assignment.
We will not have any class on March 10, 12, and 14. As you know, that's so I can go to California to that meeting. And I'd like you to write a well-organized paper in some depth on a chemical subject that hopefully has by now caught your attention. Organize it with title, subtitles, and good lead-off sentences so that H.T. Hall can speed read it. 10 to 100 pages will be okay. Now, if it were sophisticated enough and original enough, I'd accept one page. I don't think length has a thing to do with the quality of a paper. But you can, if you send me a 100-page one done personally and I can't speed read it real well, you may not get a very good grade on it. But I do recognize that some of you may want to go that hard at it. So almost any length paper you want to write. Now, make it so that somebody could understand it, such as yourself, who presumably are taking a first course in chemistry. I don't need anything on the superlatives of the quantum theory or anything like that. Unless some of you really want to do it. I mean, don't do that because you think that may make it a better paper. But if you really have a drive to do that, okay. Some of you have had some chemistry. Now, do you have any questions on this little project?
Is this geared up like a term paper with footnotes and all the shebang?
No, I don't need any references. No references required. Use your own style. I don't like the University of Chicago style manual anyway. And I will not take off for misspelled words or typing errors. Things like that. And you will not be graded on the English, except it ought to be readable. It ought to be readable.
Would you want it in by?
And I want it in by the Monday following this, which would, let's see, that's a Friday, 15, 16, 17. Do, begin,
thank
class.
You.
What day will it be?
I just
March. Let's see, that's a Friday, I think. Somebody want to check me on that? So Saturday's 15th, signs the 16th, would be the 17th, I guess.
Monday is the 17th, yeah.
Let's see it, okay.
Any subject or thing that we've touched on in class?
Doesn't have to have been. My idea of an honors program, I think, agrees with the idea of the people who run the thing. Hopefully I can inspire you. And it need not be what I've been talking about. If that's led you to something that interests you, then that's just great. Now, if I were a good enough teacher, all of you would change over to be chem majors. But I'm sure that's not going to happen.
Watching graphs, maybe like a paper on patterns, that really doesn't have to do with chemistry.
Well, yes, it does. If you wanted to follow that further along, that'd be okay. But you ought to get the atoms and the molecules in there a little bit. A little bit. The question here.
Do you want some kind of like a thesis, like proving something, or just do you want the information that we found?
It would not have to be a thesis to prove anything, no. And it can be serious or humorous or most anything. I suspect most of them will be serious, but if some of you have some real chemical humor, great. And the subject really needs it.
On how widely
applied
chemistry to catch the wood.
You'd like to do something historical? I would accept that. Now, I would want it to include, you know, something like Lavoisier's discovery of oxygen, or something like that. Or something on the phlogiston theory. Yeah, a historical paper would be all right. Now look, I know that you'll be able to go to the literature, particularly the dictionaries and encyclopedias, And they'll sort of have an article written for you already. Now, I've read all those, so don't do it that way. Please make it original. At least, see, now, say, it's okay to read those, but if you find an article just the right length in Kirk Othmer's journal, what does he call it, dictionary, or no, Encyclopedia of Chemical Technology, then that's not, you haven't gone far enough. You need to read that one and read some more. And check chemical abstracts or find some other sources about a particular subject. Now, you may want to write on something I haven't got to yet. We will get to thermodynamics and a lot of other interesting things forward through. Thermodynamics could be an interesting subject. Yeah?
What about philosophy of science?
All right, philosophy of science would be okay too. But try and get a couple atoms and molecules in it, will you? No, I saw a hand over here somewhere. Well, Clayton?
I guess the answer's already out. But last semester, I wrote a paper for Dr. Hickman's biology seminar. We correlated biology with our major. So
you want to correlate chemistry with economics?
Yeah.
I'd accept that. Just don't rely on that other paper too much. Brother Williams.
You say good lead-in sentences. Does that mean that the first sentence of the paragraph should be something, and then so you can just read the first sentence of each paragraph and not even care about what's in it?
Oh, no. I'll read the first sentence, and then I'll scan the rest of the paragraph. See, you know, instead of reading it like this, I'll read the rest of the paragraph like that. You better have the first sentence for me to read. That's just good writing anyway. A good writer will always do that. I'm just trying to improve your English composition. Do I see some other hands on this? Well, go to work now. In fact, I would hope from what I've been saying, they already may have been exploring some of these things to see what you can find. But history and philosophy and correlation of the subject with your major, they'd be good. Or just dead serious chemical exposition about atomic orbitals or molecular orbitals or some of those kind of things. About isotopes, about atomic theory. How many sort of have an idea for a topic already? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Better than half of you. Okay. Let's see, who's the brother that wanted to borrow my tapes?
Yeah.
Let's see, what I have here is January 31st, February 3rd, 5th, and 7th. Is that the cover of the ground?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what do you want to know about spectroscopic electronic notation for atoms? I covered it all, but maybe you have some questions. I covered it all that I would think you ought to know. Okay?
What applications does it have beyond helping to explain how a specific element will react?
What is the usefulness of this idea? The usefulness of it probably comes in its complexities, which we haven't gotten to and which we won't get to. You've already mentioned one of the use. It does correlate and explain by the correlation, if you call it correlation an explanation, why the alkali metals have similar chemical behavior. See, all alkali metals would be characterized by the outermost electron being NS1, where N is the principal quantum number. Consequently, all of those elements would tend to be electropositive elements. It would like to lose this single electron and become the ion like Na+. And you can say a similar thing about all the others. See in group two where you have NS2, that's beryllium, magnesium, calcium, and so on. They all tend to behave the same, and we say that they behave the same because each one has two electrons in this S orbit. Now it's true, they're in different quantum levels, different principal quantum numbers, and that does make them different. But there is a correlation. There's a standard behavior of the alkaline earth tends to form basic substances and whatnot that's due to that. But as you go deeper in the periodic table, there will be a periodic change in that characteristic of the first element that's in the column. And you can say the same for the rest of them. Electronic structure, particularly the outermost electrons, up to the 8 outermost electrons. Sometimes it goes to 10. Characterizes the chemical properties of that element. So a chemist knows this in much greater detail than we want to go into in this class. And he uses it in his thinking when he tries to make chemical compounds. He says, well, magnesium carbonate does this, and I want something that is just a little less basic, and I want something that would accept hydrogen in a certain fashion. Some problem he may have. If I just drop down to the next element and made that a calcium carbonate instead of magnesium, maybe it would do the job I need. So it's another correlating factor that fits in with the periodic table. What I've tried to have you do is memorize the outline of the periodic table and then web this electronic structure nomenclature to that, where you have the alkali metals, alkaline earths, the group 3A's beginning with boron, the group 4A's beginning with carbon, such as germanium, tin, lead, and then the neckties beginning with nitrogen, phosphorus, oxygen, sulfur, selenium, which are the catechinides, and then the halogens, and then the rare gases. And just with that correlation there, you know darn near half of the principal elements that we deal with in our everyday lives. And through the center, we have this group where we're filling up d orbitals, you see, that we call the transition elements. And then we have these elements down here that are all very much alike in their chemical properties because they have f electrons, which are deeply buried, which leaves, as a rule, one d electron and two s electrons to do the chemical bonding, while the f electron is added as we go across the chart in the rare earths. It doesn't change the chemical properties much. Chemistry is almost all identical because this is what the outermost electron is. It's an Md, Ms2 electron. And then you have down here the actinides, which tend to get awfully radioactive. Most of them are synthetic. Important elements there, uranium and plutonium. So you sort of have an outline of the whole periodic table. Okay?
Is there really a limit to how many electrons you can have in a certain orbital? Like some of the S's only go up to this number, but like when we have the D's, there's up to
D10. There's a limit, yes. Maybe we should review that. S electrons can have a maximum of 2. P electrons a maximum of 6. D electrons maximum of 10, F electrons a maximum of 14. And that's as far as you need to go on the periodic table. Those are the maximum numbers. Now there are subdivisions of these. P orbitals, often we write orbitals as circles, or some books as squares. And a single square can have, or circle, can have no more than 2 electrons. There's another law, this adds to the complexity of the thing, but I guess I can throw in this extra thing. There is a law that says that no more than 2 electrons is the maximum in any orbital, and now they're talking about suborbitals, really. Now, if we speak about S electrons, I can draw one circle like that, which represents the S orbital. Be 2 electrons in. They spin in opposite directions. Electrons spin, creating a magnetic field. When there are 2 of them in the same orbital, they spin in opposite directions and nullify each other's magnetic field. Any spinning electric charge generates a magnetic field. Now, when you get to p orbitals, there can be 3 of these. you want to subdivide these, you call them px, p sub y, and p sub z orbitals. As you add electrons and manufacturing elements in our head, as you've seen us do, the electrons go one there, and one there, and one there, as you add electrons. And then it goes back and goes like that. We call that electrons going in parallel. And they do that not only in p orbitals, but in d and f orbitals. See, you might say, why don't they go in like that? Fill the px first, and then the py, and then the pz. Well, it's an invention. You invent it to go in parallel. If we were doing, let's make oxygen. Let's see. We'd be in the 2p orbitals, and we would come to our first p orbital at boron. So there'd be boron. It would have 2s electrons. There'd be boron, and there'd be carbon, there'd be nitrogen, and there'd be oxygen. And then if we made the nitrogen, there'd be one there. I'm sorry, we already made nitrogen. We made fluorine, and then we made neon. We'd be there. Now see, all of these put together make P6, six electrons. Now you get the d orbitals, you have to have five of these. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now as you make, they have more complicated nomenclature here that I won't go into. But as you put in electrons, making your first transition element, that would be scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese. Now those of you who know chemistry, who've had a high school course, will know that already I have to make another exception. But I gotta quit making these exceptions, they never end. So first approximation, you get that one, that one, that one, that one, that one. Let's see, scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese, iron, cobalt, nickel, and copper, and zinc. And then you get down here to the f electrons, then you have to have seven of these suborbitals, because only two can go in each one. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They would go lanthanum, praseodymium, neodymium, samarium. I probably left out neodymium again. Anyway, barium, terbium, holmium, rubidium, etc. On up to the end. Okay.
Okay. Now that we know what we're supposed to look at, how does it really happen?
I don't want to get that complicated. Well, I've already brought in too much extra stuff. But I do want to tell you something else about these electrons. The reason the scheme has been invented to have electrons go in and in parallel is because of magnetism. Now, there are different kinds of magnetism. The kind of magnetism you're familiar with is when you take a magnet, you know, lift up a piece of steel with it. Well, that's called ferromagnetism. Ferro being the Greek or the Latin word for iron. Ferromagnetism. Now, ferromagnetism does depend on the fact that you have unpaired electrons. See, when there's an electron in a suborbital, like this px orbital, there's magnetism due to that, because it's spinning a certain direction. If I put in a second one, then the magnetism is gone for that orbital. A substance, then, that has three electrons all in parallel would have more magnetism. And we call this kind of magnetism paramagnetism. This is not ferro. This is paramagnetism. Now, there's oxygen again. See, we have a couple of 2s electrons, and even before that there were a couple of 1s electrons. And then, no, that's not oxygen. This is boron. This is boron. Right, now boron will have a certain amount of paramagnetism because it has one unpaired electron. But the next element, which is carbon, will have more paramagnetism because now there are two unpaired electrons. And the next element, which is nitrogen, will have still more paramagnetism. Then you come to oxygen, then you start reducing the paramagnetism. See, there are only two that are impaired, and then you come to the next element, which is fluorine. The paramagnetism is reduced, and then when you get to neon, it's gone again. So see, when you have the maximum number of unpaired electrons, you'll have the maximum in paramagnetism. All right, now what ferromagnetism is macroscopic paramagnetism. Iron has d orbitals. Let's take iron here. There are things besides iron that can be magnetic. As a matter of fact, the best magnets are alloys of a couple of metals. But now let's see. We've made scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese. There's iron. It has 1, 2, 3, 4 unpaired electrons, which would give it a lot of paramagnetism if you had one iron atom by itself. Now what happens in iron? There is a phenomenon that is called in science a cooperative phenomenon. When you put iron in a magnetic direct current field, the atoms, by the millions, flip over and orient their axis so that electrons are spinning in the same direction. Millions of them. Now see, in iron in a material ordinarily, the atoms are all mixed up, unless it's a crystalline substance. Now, there's more complications to solid substance than just being the simple patterns I've told you about. That's the first thing I have. Even in that crystalline pattern, the electrons can be spinning. Let's say all these electrons are spinning the same direction in that one atom. There may be another atom that's turned upside down where it's spinning the other. And it's close enough to it that it cancels out the effects of these, even though it's not an electron in the same orbit. It will cancel out, on the macroscopic scale, what we human beings can observe. They call these things domains. Magnetic domains. And there's a very interesting property in iron and other ferromagnetic materials. If you take a very sensitive microscope, I don't mean microscope, but very sensitive stethoscope or amplifier, microphone's what I'm trying to think of, and hold it on a piece of iron that is non-magnetized, and then put it in a strong magnetic field, you hear clicks, click, 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 click. Physical domains of iron in the crystal are turning over and aligning in the magnetic field. And these domains that twist and turn over are large enough that you can see them under an electron microscope. It's a very interesting phenomenon. So you're not working at the atomic scale, you're working on a mass scale. You can see under a light microscope, or it's at the extreme of a light microscope, you can see it with an electron. Where these domains turn over, and it takes work to turn them over, and they make noise when they turn over. And you can hear the amplifier. Now in a gas like oxygen, which would have paramagnetism, see the oxygen atoms are every which way. It's non-crystalline structure. But that magnetism can be measured. And in an inhomogeneous magnetic field, you can take liquid oxygen, and you can be pouring it from one beaker into another beaker, door flask, I better say, you gotta keep it cold. And then you bring a magnet there that has an inhomogeneous magnetic field. That's non-uniform, stronger in some regions than others. The oxygen will bend in that field as it flows through due to its paramagnetism. But paramagnetic effects tend to be weak, and you only observe them in non-homogeneous fields. Whereas ferromagnetism is a cooperative phenomenon where trillions upon trillions of atoms have aligned themselves so electrons are spinning in the same direction by the umpteen billions. And that's ferromagnetism. Okay?
Okay, this kind of axis orientation that we're talking about here, is that the same kind of axis orientation that we're talking about when you talked about diamonds?
It's different.
It's different, okay.
I shouldn't say that it's different. It's not the same. It is related to it. It is related to it. See, arbitrarily, we consider an atom to be a round orange-like thing. So how the electrons are spinning in there, if that's not free to move, may be that way. But for the crystal lattice, the crystal lattice doesn't really care. See, the magnetism may be there, but the atoms are all randomly oriented with respect to each other. So they, on the average, cancel each other out. There's no visible magnetism on a microscopic level. If you were smaller than an atom and could go down there, you could see the magnetism of an individual atom, supposedly. But there are some substances, namely iron and iron group elements, iron, cobalt, nickel, and other elements when alloyed, where, and this is not completely understood, but for some reason, all these atoms flip over so that every electron that's unpaired has its spinning axis oriented with a crystallographic axis. And then it's ferromagnetic because you have the cooperation of these things by the millions, which give you a strong effect. Cooperative phenomena in science are the most difficult things to understand. Cooperative phenomena. Atoms and molecules tend to act in whatever property you're describing it in a statistical fashion, a random distribution of properties. But there are certain phenomena where things get together and cooperate. If out of a mass of random oriented molecules you get a crystal, there has to be some cooperation for all these things to line up like soldiers by the millions in this thing. To melt a crystal, there has to, just the opposite, there has to be a cooperative phenomenon. Cooperative phenomena tend to take place sharply. A crystal melts at a certain temperature. You give me a crystal of sodium chloride and I start heating it up, and all of a sudden you hit the correct temperature, which I believe is 846 degrees, and suddenly liquid appears, just like that. It's not a slow thing. It doesn't soften and get squishy. It's solid and strong, and then it suddenly is liquid. And that melting phenomenon is called a cooperative phenomenon. And the opposite of the randomly oriented molecules in a liquid suddenly lining up and coming out in the crystal solid. Just reverses the crystal as a cooperative phenomenon. The property of having ferromagnetism is a cooperative phenomenon. There are low temperature phenomena, such as the infinite electrical conductivity. Every electrical substance now known that conducts electricity, metals conduct electricity, they have a fixed resistance. But if you take lead and copper and almost any metal you name and cool it to a low enough temperature, you'll carry almost any amount of electric current. That's called superconducting phenomena. And one thing Jeff does over in our lab, we're trying to find superconductors that have a higher transition temperature. The highest temperature in absolute degrees that a known substance has this property is around 23 degrees centigrade. Now the electric power companies would like to have something with superconducting room temperature. I don't know what you've ever observed about electricity, but the more electricity you carry, the bigger the wire you have to have. The higher the current, the bigger the wire. You can get more power through by raising the voltage, but there's a limit to that. It becomes dangerous. This costs money. It's expensive. We're on the verge of going to very tiny electrical conductors. You could build an electric motor with 100 horsepower as big as your fist if you had conductors in that motor at room temperature that would conduct any amount of electricity you wanted to put through it. Also, you could levitate trains. You could make magnetic fields almost as powerful as you wanted to make. You had an electrical conductor that would conduct without resistance. So electrical resistance robs you of your power. It's electrons traveling through a wire. That's what electricity is that comes to your house in wires. It's electrons moving through copper. Now there's a resistance to the flow of those electrons. And the electrons heat the wire as they pass through. Now, if you want an electrical heater, then you make a wire that has a high resistance. Alloys of manganese, nickel manganese, for example, has a very high electrical resistance. So if you want an electric heater in your bathroom to warm your feet or something on cold days, you wind this nichrome, nickel and chromium, or nickel chrome manganese wire, you've seen it coiled on ceramic stuff, and you pass electricity through it, and it heats up so warm that it glows. Well, electric light is the same thing, only the filament there is tungsten. It doesn't have as high a resistance as some of these manganese and chromium and nickel alloys. So, sometimes you want the resistance. See, if you want to turn electricity into heat, then you want this high resistance wire. But if you want to carry electricity from New York to San Francisco, you want something with zero resistance. Approximately 20% of the power is lost in taking it from the electric power station to wherever it goes as an average, because of the resistance of the wires. Now, when they make the wires as big, there's an economical thing. Engineers, you see, work with optimum conditions. You decide how big the wire can be, how much power you're willing to lose. All these things you base on the wind load, how heavy the wire is, how strong the transmission towers are, and the cost of the whole thing. That's engineering, deciding all those factors and making the wire exactly the right size for the situation. But there are experimental situations now where you just take a fine wire, no bigger than a lead pencil, it's made out of niobium and tin, and you enclose it in liquid helium. It'll carry all electricity that would light the city of New York. Just one little wire, not a bit. Now that's what is hoped for in the future of electrical power transmission. And there are some of us here in the audience who are working on that problem. Clayton?
What's this material that you have that will do it at 23 degrees?
It's a compound of niobium and tin. Niobium 310. Oh, this won't go to, I'm sorry, this is, what is it, Jeff, do you remember what this one is? This is only about a 15 to 17, somewhere in there.
I don't know what the 23 degree one is.
What's, you say you do or don't?
I don't.
The 23 degree one is a complex thing. It's actually a non-stoichiometric compound, I intend to use a new word. When we first teach you chemistry, we teach you that there are exact ratios of atoms, like here. There are three niobium atoms to every 10 atoms. And we write chemical formulas based on that idea that there are fixed definite compounds. Well, there are. There are lots of them. But there are some compounds that chemists had a hard time understanding for years. You may have a compound, niobium 2.75, 10, 6 tenths, real oddball. Those are called non-stoichiometers. And we have explanations for that nowadays. It's due mainly to energy considerations, field of thermodynamics that we haven't discussed yet. But if you have a crystal lattice, and I'll just draw a two-dimensional one here where these dots on the board represent the centers of atoms. Energy sometimes favors not having an atom there, having an atom missing every once in a while in the crystal. And that's called a lattice vacancy. There's a place where the pattern says there ought to be an atom, but there's a statistical average distribution of 1/10 of the places that don't have an atom. And that's what leads to non-stoichiometry. Non-stoichiometry exists, well, I am sure, only in solids. You wouldn't have it in gaseous molecules. Might have it in liquid molecules, but it's mainly dealt with in the solid state where atoms are missing from certain points, lattice sites, where the motif ought to be, it ain't. Now, some of those kind of compounds, strangely enough, which contain three elements, X, Y, and Z, are in the forefront of this research on trying to find compounds that will raise the temperature at which some materials are conducting, superconducting. Now you may ask me, how can you do that? Well, the reason you want to get the temperature higher is because liquid helium is darn expensive. And you have to cool things
we cool things with liquefied gases, mainly hydrogen and helium. Helium is expensive, it's rare, eventually the world will run out of it. And you lose it in the cooling process. If you can use hydrogen, there's plenty of that around. But hydrogen can only cool to 20 degrees, I think. We're talking about absolute degrees. I don't know if we even discussed temperature scales in this class, have we?
No.
Well, we don't have time to do it today either. Well, I'm talking about temperatures that are many degrees below our ordinary Fahrenheit freezing point. There is an absolute zero beyond which man cannot go. There's a zero of temperature, and man cannot go below that temperature. If that interests you, you might go right about that. That'd be an interesting subject. How come there's an absolute zero? Why can't there be negative temperatures and things like that? Okay?
My brother, who patted me on the head and told me that it was above my knowledge, wrote a paper. He did some experimentation, and he wrote a paper on superconductivity of niobium, titanium, vanadium alloys. And since he told me it was above my comprehension, I never stopped to ask him, why choose niobium, titanium, vanadium? You have niobium to look into.
Is he a physicist somewhere?
Yeah, in Los Alamos.
In Los Alamos. Yeah, okay. He works on the same kind of stuff we do then.
But why choose niobium? Why?
They work.
All right. But why things are superconductors is a tough question. It's another cooperative phenomenon where electrons, which usually occur in pairs, apparently can do something else in the normal pairing. And it's a very tough theory that I have tried to read and understand, and I can't. Well, I wouldn't say I can't. I don't want to put in the effort required. There are more interesting things to me. But the theory is due to Bardeen, Schaefer. Do you call the other initial that name? Bardeen? The three guys wrote the theory. Guys at Bell Telephone. Now, again, it has to do with electrons. Empirically, there's a guy by the name of Matthias. What about Matthias?
He's a good friend of my dad. He used to work at Los Alamos.
Yeah, okay. This guy has the reputation of being the world's authority in the field. We work with him. We make the stuff, his group down in San Diego, test it out and see if it's any good. This guy is an empiricist. He looks at the periodic table and he finds out where superconducting things occur. And from that, he shows charge that gives you the electron per atom ratio in alloys. Like if you have metal X with metal Y. Metal X furnishes so many electrons in the valence band, like we've been talking about. And Y furnishes so many. If this electron atom ratio is around 6, it's likely to be a good semiconductor. Also, if it's around 3 or 4, there are a couple of regions along an E per M curve versus the superconducting transition temperature. And there's a bump here at 6, and there's one down here around 3 or 4. That's empirical knowledge. Not based on any theory, just an observation. But the periodic table is extremely useful to chemists and everybody. That's why I'm teaching it to you. If you know some of these things, then you make periodic table correlations and you forget about these big high-powered quantum mechanical theories.
Forget all about that.
And Matthias wrote an article in Scientific American, and he's absolutely right. These guys got the Nobel Prize for developing this theory. And Matthias said, you name me one new high-temperature semiconductor that's ever come from that theory. And there ain't one.
Well,
in other words, the theory hasn't ever done anybody any good, and yet the guys get the Nobel Prize for it.
They got two years,
what's that?
What's the difference between a superconductor and a semiconductor?
Well, a semiconductor is a pore. A semiconductor is a substance that's in between being a metal and a non-metal. Remember the Zinner-Bohr deal? This thing down like that, The elements along this border here are called semiconductors. You got metals out here and non-metals over here. They're the in-between elements. And they have certain properties that are useful in making our calculators and all that. But now to get back to your brother. He tries to make these alloys of X, Y, and Z. What do you say he had? Niobium and tin.
Titanium.
Sometimes they go up to a fourth one. He tries to put those in there to shade this electron atom ratio. He'll work around 6, but there's some unknown factors, not yet understood. So the first thing you have to do is get a situation where you have an average of about 6 electrons per atom. But then vary from that by throwing in some sulfur or titanium or some other things and hopefully raise it just a degree or a tenth of a degree or whatever. Get it up there in the liquid hydrogen range so that we can, if that happens, there'll be a new technology in the world. It'll be worth to the world that hold billions and billions of dollars to get a good practical superconducting metal alloy that would conduct, say, at 25 or 30 degrees, be a superconductor. That'd really be a great thing. And there are a lot of guys working on that, including your brother.
Important. No,
he did.
He asked me somewhere around
the
net ratio of
16. Jeff, according to my clock, we should let this class up. No?
5 minutes or so.
I was just wondering about the magnetic properties of superconductors.
Well, he's trying to get me into another deal.
That's really interesting, though. Another
problem is it's great to get a superconductor that will conduct at 23 degrees above absolute. But if you pass 1,000,000 amps through that semiconductor, there's going to be a terrific magnetic field around. And the magnetic field can destroy, and does in many instances, the superconducting property. So that limits the amount of current that you can carry. So they call that, what do they call that, Jeff?
I don't know.
Critical field. They call it the critical field. So you must have a high critical field. In other words, it must be, the thing must remain superconducting at, say, 100 kilogauss of magnetic energy. Unfortunately, that's not a problem with a lot of these things. Once in a while it is, but not always. So the magnetic field of carrying a lot of current can destroy the superconductivity of the substance. That's what you want me to say, wasn't it? Oh, what were you saying?
Randy was telling me about how a superconducting magnet that behaves just like the quantum energies in the atom. It's like it's got a macro atom there.
Yeah, that's this Bardeen, Schreifer. Why can't I get the other name?
I didn't understand. I was just wondering. That's kind of interesting.
Can't think of the other guy. Well, electrons are it. Electrons are mighty important.
Okay. So what does a cryotron look like?
Cryotron. That's the thing to generate low temperature. Is that right? Or is it
something? What I had in mind was a substitution for a transistor, or it's a controlling gate.
I don't know what one is. I think I've heard the term somewhere in passing, but I don't know what it is. I thought it might be a cooler, a refrigerator. Refrigerators that can generate these awfully low temperatures are very special things. And in the ultimate end, they all depend on the evaporation of either hydrogen or of helium for the cooling effect. Have you been swimming in the lake and then you get out and there's a breeze blowing by and you feel colder than the dickens? That's a phenomena of evaporation. When liquids evaporate, cooling takes place. And you really are chilled. The evaporation of the water chills you. And the reason on a hot day you like to have a fan blowing on you is because your perspiration gets evaporated. That's called evaporative cooling, the simplest kind of cooling. Trees do it, dogs do it, men do it. You keep cool by evaporating the water from your system. Now, automobiles cool themselves by a different system in a sense, but it isn't. You do it internally. It's an internal evaporation that takes place inside pipes and whatnot. I guess almost all good systems of cooling do that. Yeah, and a refrigerator does the same. Well, but to just transpire or evaporate liquid from the system, which is the simplest way nature's been doing it for years, is the way you reach the coldest temperature. You use a refrigerator, a super duper refrigerator, like your Sears Roebuck in your house, whatever kind you have, that cools liquid helium or hydrogen. And then to get the additional cooling, you evaporate that liquid. You boil it away, and that's how you get down to these very low temperatures. Okay?
Explain how a refrigerator works.
Why don't you ask me next time and I'll tell you.
Okay.
We've got to do thermodynamics first, though. Keep it on your mind, because I'll forget it on mine. But next week, sometime, we will probably start talking about thermodynamics. And when we get a little of that under our belt, then we can tell you how a refrigerator works. Okay, see you on Wednesday.
I've got a book.